The NBA playoffs are here, and with FanDuel, your group chat's about to be going off. Because right now, new customers can bet $5 and get $150 in bonus bets if you win. And with live bets, your heart emojis will really be racing from tip-off to the final buzzer. Plus, when you win, you'll get paid faster than your friends can send you a victory gift. Or is it GIF? Who cares? You won! So get the word out to your crew and download FanDuel today. New customers bet $5 to get $150 in bonus bets if you win. Make every moment more with FanDuel, America's number one sportsbook. Official partner of the NBA.
21 plus and present in Ohio. First online real money wager only. $10 first deposit required. Bonus issued is non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire 7 days after receipt. See full terms at FanDuel.com/sportsbook. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
You're listening to Weird Medicine with Dr. Steve on the Riotcast Network, riotcast.com. I need to touch it.
I've got diphtheria crushing my esophagus. I've got Ebola virus dripping from my nose. I've got the leprosy of the heart valve, exacerbating my incredible woes. I want to take my brain out and blast it with the wave, an ultrasonic echographic and a pulsating shave. I want a magic pill for my ailments, the health equivalent to Citizen Kane. And if I don't get it now in the tablet, I think I'm doomed and I'll have to go insane. I want a requiem for my disease. So I'm paging Dr. Steve.
Dr. Steve.
It's Weird Medicine, the first and still only uncensored medical show in the history of broadcast radio. Also a podcast. I'm Dr. Steve, and this is a show for people who would never listen to a medical show on the radio or the internet. If you got a question, you're embarrassed to take to your regular medical provider. If you can't find an answer anywhere else, give us a call at 347-766-4323. That's 347-POOHEAD. I don't know. Visit our website at drsteve.com for podcasts, medical news, and stuff you can buy, or go to our merchandise store at cafepress.com/weirdmedicine, where I'll make literally 25 cents. So, don't worry about that so much. But you can get a Bristol Stool Scale mug, which is a pretty cool white elephant Christmas gift. It's got pictures of stool on it, and you can judge your stools, your bowel movements as you drink your cup of coffee in the morning. Most importantly, we are not your medical providers. Take everything you hear with a grain of salt. Don't act on anything you hear on this show without talking it over with your doctor, nurse practitioner, physician assistant, pharmacist, chiropractor, acupuncturist, yoga master, physical therapist, clinical laboratory scientist, registered dietitian, or whatever. Hey, we're getting close to the holidays. Next week, we're going to have Chrissy Mayer on the show. She is delightful, by the way, and it's going to be a good show. We're going to talk about flu vaccine and sex headaches and all kinds of crazy stuff. And check her out at patreon.com/Chrissy. That's CHRISSIEMAYR.com or whatever. Patreon.com/Chrissy Mayer. Check her out on Twitter as well, and I think she's got, you know, she's young, she's got all the social media you young kids have, don't you know? Well, check out stuff.drsteve.com, stuff.drsteve.com for all your online shopping needs, and tweakedaudio.com. Best stocking stuffers or Hanukkah gifts or earbuds. And with offer code FLUID, you get 33% off, and that's a great deal. And best customer service anywhere. So tweakedaudio.com, offer code FLUID. Check out Dr. Scott's website at simplyherbals.net. And really, if you want to hit your ideal body weight, as I did with me, go to noom.drsteve.com. Noom, N-O-O-M, .drsteve.com. You get 2 weeks free and 20 percent off if you decide to sign up for it. And if you decide to sign up for it, it's not like some of these other ones. You don't have to do it forever. You do it for 3 months and you're done. If you're lazy, like I am, and who isn't, you can get Freshly, delivering fresh prepared meals that make eating right super easy. They're all gluten-free and reasonably healthy. I like the steak peppercorn. Comes with, you know, green beans and julienned carrots and some, I don't know if it's mashed potatoes or mashed cauliflower, but it's good. Whatever it is, it's awesome. I have a steak every week, thanks to Freshly. You can use my link to get six dinners for $39 for 2 weeks. That's $20 off each week. Give it a try. Let me know what you think. It's not for everybody, okay? But if you like it, it's awesome, and it is absolutely convenient. And then if you want archives of this show, why would you? But if you do, go to premium.drsteve.com, and you can just use offer code FLUID. You get a deal. If you're interested in getting a flash drive with about 17 gigs of content on it, and, you know, that leaves whatever 32 minus 17 is, was that 15, whatever, I don't know, 15 gigs of, I'm supposed to be smart. You know, I have an IQ of 165, and I've gotten to the point where it's really hard for me to do math in my head anymore, but that, I think that's more of a function of drinking and of being 60, almost 65 years old. So anyway, you get dumb. Where was I? Don't even remember. So don't worry about it. Let's see what we got on the show today. Uh-oh. Well, listen, what a coincidence. Tacy, you're on Weird Medicine.
I thought you were recording at 4.
Yes,
call
and
me when you can.
Okay. Bye. It's always just such a coincidence. It doesn't matter when I'm recording that she calls, happens to call me. You know why that is? It's not like she's stalking me and knows when I'm recording, because that's impossible. Nor would she have the energy or the desire to know what I'm doing, but that's how many times a day she calls me, so that's just what that is. All right. I'm so sorry. Hey, I wanted to do an update on the Boston Chemical accident, so we now know what the chemicals were. We talked about this last week. This is a really sad story, and it was and this is from Burlington or Boston CBS, and it says the employee who died after a chemical incident at a Buffalo Wild Wings restaurant in Burlington has been identified as 32-year-old Ryan Baldera of Lawrence. And this guy, kind of a hero in the sense that, well, he is, in the sense that he went in to help somebody else with a problem and ended up losing his life over it. Baldera is a general manager. He jumped in to help with another employee using a common cleaning agent known as Super 8 on the kitchen floor, suddenly became nauseous. That is not a word. Sorry. Nauseous isn't a word. It's nauseated. Things can be nauseous. Things that cause, have the capability of making you nauseated are nauseous. Look it up. This is journalists. Okay. Matter of fact, you all don't believe me. I know you don't. My old boss in Londonderry, Vermont, that was one of his pet peeves, as my medical students would. And he was British, very proper, but hilarious dude, and very, very smart. And I remember one of my medical students was presenting to him, and she said, yeah, this patient's nauseous. Of course, she was from the, you know, the Northeast somewhere. And he was like, that's not a, well, I can't do a British accent. But anyway, in his British accent, you know, that's not a word. It's nauseated. Okay, so the here we go. Because people have been using it incorrectly, it's become part of the lexicon. So it actually is a, God dang it. In the latest dictionary, nauseous is now afflicted with nausea. That was not the case. The correct, but of course that's English, so these words keep changing as we use them incorrectly. And this is, well, I'll take a second to talk about the euphemism treadmill too, but okay, so the correct definition is causing nausea, offensive to taste or smell. That smell was nauseous. Okay. So, God, that's dictionary. Let me find a better dictionary. And see, and then when you got competing dictionaries. Okay, let's just see. Okay, Merriam-Webster will agree. And if I'm wrong, yeah, it's number one is causing nausea or disgust. The nauseous smell of rotting garbage. Thank you. Okay. Okay, here we go. Now, here's an article about it. It says, those who insist that nauseous can properly be used only to mean causing nausea and that it's later affected with nausea, meaning as an error for nauseated, are mistaken. Well, all right, I guess I'm wrong then. Current evidence shows these facts. Nauseous is most frequently used to mean physically affected with nausea. Okay, so because it's commonly used that way does not make it correct. For example, ironic doesn't mean, oh, what a weird juxtaposition. You know, ironic is when you say something and you mean the opposite. Sarcasm is a better synonym for ironic or sarcastic. Okay, but anyway, nauseated is used more widely than nauseous when being referred to as being affected with nausea. Well, okay, so it's still controversial, so they're saying it's incorrect, but, you know, where's their authority? This is just from some damn thesaurus article. So, yes, current, if we're going to define English based on how we use these words, then, yeah, ironic just means weird juxtaposition of things. You know, since we all understand it, I guess I'm just being a dick. Let's talk a little bit about I'll take back the boo that I gave to the journalist because apparently it is accepted to say nauseous. Euphemism treadmill, I brought this up. So back in the day, there were words that were used medically that were acceptable. So definition, let's just use moron of moron. Okay, well now moron is a stupid person, but there was a medical definition. That's okay. Now Merriam-Webster made me laugh. Medical. Let's look for the medical definition of moron. And okay, I'm finding it under the Wikipedia for imbecile. So the term imbecile was once used by psychiatrists to denote a category of people with moderate to severe intellectual disability, as well as a type of criminal. The word arises from the Latin word imbecilius, meaning weak or weak-minded. It included people with IQ of 26 to 50, which was between idiot, IQ of 0 to 25, and moron, an IQ of 51 to 70. In the obsolete medical classification ICD-9, which is 1977, these people were said to have moderate mental retardation or moderate mental subnormality. Now, all of these words that I just used were turned around and used as pejoratives. So people would, hey, you idiot. Hey, moron. Hey, retard. And then even subnormal Well, he's a subnormal piece of shit or whatever, you know. So these words became pejorative. People started using them that way. And since the meaning now shifted, where idiot before was a person with an extremely low IQ, now when you called somebody an idiot, meaning it in a pejorative sense, it reflected poorly and was offensive to people who were actual idiots. So those terms had to change. And so now we may, you know, call or even mentally retarded is was subject to the euphemism treadmill. And that became derogatory as well. And so now we'll say, you know, whatever, the intellectual disability or whatever. So all of these things are now under the stratus of intellectual disability, and then you may stratify them again by IQ if you're using IQ, or just their functional ability. Okay, and that seems much less easy to then turn around and turn into something that you're yelling at somebody in a pejorative way. So that's the euphemism treadmill. Words become that are medical terms usually that then become pejorative terms that then become changed into a euphemism to make them less offensive. Midget is another one of these. Although the little people community have used, you know, embraced the term dwarf because that's a medical term. Midget used to be a medical term as well. There were midgets who were dwarfs, and then there were midgets who were proportioned, and there were proportional dwarfs and achondroplastic dwarfs, and the proportional dwarfs were also considered midgets. Well, that term is no longer acceptable. It is offensive, and to the little people community, and therefore, you know, it was also subject to this euphemism treadmill. So, all right. So nausea. Okay, so let's get back to this story. Sorry, I got shiny object. You know, if they had known what ADD was when I was a kid, I would have done so much better in school. I mean, I ended up doing okay. As an adult, having ADD in the job that I have, actually good, because I can hyper focus when I need to, and I can also, you know, do multiple things at once and be things catch my attention, which is good when you're trying to make a diagnosis on a patient. You want little things to catch your attention, and you dog them to the end, because that's good for diagnostic. You don't want to be blowing things off and big picturing everything. So it's good for me now. It was a real struggle back in the day when I would make 99th percentile on these. They were Iowa basics at the time. They were the standardized tests of the day. I would get 99th percentile on the Iowa basics and then be making C's and D's in school. It drove my parents crazy. And so I was labeled underachiever, which underachiever means lazy ass. And so I just got in trouble all the time. My teachers, I remember Miss Johnson in the fifth grade, what a harridan this person was. And just minimized me. I don't know how I didn't just end up doing drugs. Well, okay. Well, I did do that. I don't know how I didn't just grow my hair long and wear my shoes until, well, I did all that too. So anyway, yeah, she messed me up. I blame it on her. Miss Johnson in the fifth grade kissed my ass. Of course, now I'm 60, so I would have been, what would I have been in the fifth grade? I would have been 10, right? And she would have been 30. So she was 20 years older than me. So she's 80-something now. So she's, but if she's still alive, she's already suffering. So I don't need to make her suffer anymore. But yeah, that did, you can really F a kid up. And the anti-intellectual bias at that time, like the kids' books were boring to me. So I wanted to go into the adult library and they wouldn't let me. And my mother had to have a library card, and she wouldn't do it. So I was kind of screwed. So I remember I would take five or six books out about stars in the, that were in the kids' library, and I'd walk all the way the hell home. It was, you know, I don't know, 12, 13 blocks, and I'd read them and then want to bring them back and get more books. And the woman, I remember, she had to be a high school student, but she seemed like, well, she was a young woman, and she's like, oh, no, you can't bring books back the same day. She just didn't want to mess with it. Instead of going, wow, you read all of those in one day? Let me show you where the physics books are or whatever. No, you can't bring them back in one day. So, anyway, just go F yourselves with the way you treat kids that don't fit the mold. And that was definitely me. And I still don't fit the mold, though. I'm kind of like Zelig. That's why I'm like Zelig. You know, if I'm always trying to fit in wherever I am, and usually unsuccessful. The only place I can fit in is, well, I don't know where that place is. Anyway, all right. Don't worry about it. I'm fine. I'm totally fine. Don't worry about me, none. All right, let's get back to this. Baldera, the general manager, jumped in to help when another employee using a common cleaning agent known as Super 8 on the kitchen floor suddenly became nauseous. Fire officials say the other worker accidentally mixed a second chemical called Scale Clean that caused a reaction. So remember last time we talked about what my hypothesis was they were using sodium hypochlorite, which is bleach, with some acidic thing. It could be ammonia, it could be another acid, and then releasing not only chlorine gas, but other like chloramine and other noxious gases. And in small amounts, most of those gases are irritating but not deadly, but in large amounts, particularly when they replace the oxygen in the air that you're breathing, it's really bad, and they're very caustic, too. I got one whiff of chlorine gas when I was a kid playing around in the basement mixing bleach and ammonia together because they were there, and, you know, it's what happens when you do this? And I saw it bubble up, and then I took a breath, and it felt like knives. I was inhaling little tiny knives, and I had to run out of there. And then I was okay. I coughed for a while, and I was okay after that. But that sucked, and I can't imagine being stuck in a place where you're breathing that more than one inhalation. It would really be bad. So it says it was two products were on the floor, came in contact, caused the chemical reaction that made everybody sick. Burlington Fire Chief Michael Patterson said, Baldera died after being rushed to the hospital. 13 additional people, including employees and patrons, were also hospitalized. Baldera was a beloved husband, father, son, brother, and cherished uncle, nephew, and son-in-law to his close-knit family and friends, his family said in a statement. That's just devastating. He had an asthma problem, and he was using his asthma inhaler outside when he started feeling his symptoms. So that probably contributed to it. OSHA has been notified. The restaurant has been closed for investigation. Now, where is the thing about the stuff was containing hypochlorite? Let me see if I can find another. Okay, here we go. Thursday evening, staff member inhaled the fumes of chemical solution, hypochlorite. And I guess that scale stuff is acidic, and when it was when they used the hypochlorite together with that, it released chlorine gas and probably chloramine. So, and I read another article. This isn't the article that I originally read that said that there was a bubbling when it happened, and that's the release of that gas. And if you're ever mixing or working with cleaning chemicals, don't mix them. Read the label. There should be a safety data sheet on these things, and it'll tell you what you can mix them with and what you can't. And anything containing bleach should be used by itself, not mixed with anything else. And it's a great cleaning agent, and, you know, we use it in our pools, and you can buy little spray bottles of bleach. And right next to it is the spray bottle of vinegar or ammonia. So I see people all the time, you know, they'll spray with one, then spray with the other. One's got to completely dry before you use the other one. And we're going to save some people from being exposed to this horrendous gas. Okay. And then, you know, if you mix chlorine with sodium, which sodium is also incredibly reactive. My chemistry professor at Case Western took a chunk of solid metallic sodium, and or it was either sodium or potassium, doesn't matter, it'll do the same thing. And he threw it into this pond, apparently in the quad at Case Western. I've never been there, but there's some pond. And when it hit the water, it made such a violent reaction that it exploded. There was an explosion, and the chunk of sodium flew up into the air and fell back into the water, where it promptly exploded again. And this will do this over and over again until there's a crust of, you know, usually sodium chloride or sodium hydroxide, probably more likely sodium hydroxide, on the surface of the sodium that kind of encapsulates it, stops it from being reactive anymore. You can store this stuff under oil, but you can't let it come in contact with water. And, you know, sodium is one of those, has a very reactive electron shell, and it's looking for electrons. It's positively charged, and it'll take them forever it can get them. So anyway, so you take sodium, highly reactive, and chlorine, highly reactive, and you put them together, and you get sodium chloride, which is awesome. It's salt. It's delightful. And that's where the word salary comes from, as a matter of fact. Fun fact, because apparently the Roman soldiers, part of their pay was to be paid in salt, which is funny to me. They're surrounded by ocean. Seems like it'd be pretty easy to make salt from the salt water. There's a process for doing that. And but they were paid in salt anyway. All right. Sea salt. Very fancy. Let's take a couple of phone calls here. We'll save those for next time. All right. You ready? Here we go.
Number one thing. Don't take advice from some asshole on the radio.
Thank you, Ronnie B. Absolutely true.
Hey, this is Dylan from Kansas.
Hey, Dylan.
I'm calling to talk about a injury I had at work involving a vice handle spinning and hitting me in a testicle, and now I found a lump on my testicle, and I'm not sure if it was there before or afterwards. And curious to see if I should go get checked.
Okay, so Dylan had a trauma to the juncal area, and now when he goes down there checking it out, he feels a lump. And let me see, did he say where it is? Did he say it's on the testicle or in the scrotum?
Involving a vice handle spinning and hitting me in a testicle, and now I found a lump on my testicle.
Okay, he's saying it's on the testicle, so that's key. So a lump in the scrotum usually is going to be a cyst of some sort. It could be a hematocele, I guess. That's a word. I just made that up. There might be such a thing. That would be a cyst that's filled with blood. You can get a hydrocele, which is a cyst that's filled with what? Did you say water?
Give yourself a bill.
It looks like water. It's not, but it's got water in it. It's ultra-filtrated blood, and there's a significant component of water in blood. And that's a cyst, usually of some of the lining tissues, and it can be caused by inflammation or maybe a little trauma, or sometimes it just happens. And you get this fluid-filled cyst. And you can tell if it's a hydrocele, usually, by taking a pen light and putting it behind the testicle and then looking. And if that hydrosil glows like E.T.'s finger, then it's most likely clear fluid. Still should get it checked out. Now, this guy, he doesn't know if it was there before. If he could say, yeah, I check my nuts every week, which you should be doing if you listen to this show. I say at the end of every show, I'm not kidding when I say check your stupid nuts for lumps. If he had checked it every week and it wasn't there and now it was there, you could say, yeah, definitely it's from the trauma. If, however, you don't know if it was there before, that means it could have been there before and you only discovered it because now you hurt yourself and now you're checking your nuts. So get it checked. The provider that you go to will feel your testicles and feel inside the scrotum, feel around. Could it be an epididymis? An epididymis is a normal structure. You got to have it if you're going to get sperm from the testicle into your splooge. And that's where sperm mature. And it's at the upper backside of the testicle. If you're examining it, you know, if you make a little C-clamp and feel around the back of your nuts at the very top on the back, you'll feel this squishy thing that when you kind of give it a little bit of a squeeze, it's, oh, it feels kind of like that feeling when you get kicked in the nuts. That's your epididymis. Right around there is you can have an appendix testes, an appendix epididymis. You can have an epididymal cyst. There's all kinds of little things on that backside there. A lump that's on the scrotum doesn't move. If it's firm, it feels like maybe there's a piece of terrarium gravel or anything else stuck to the surface of the testicle. That should be checked out. Could be trauma. Could be a little hematoma where you got knocked. Blood is released from little capillaries, and it's under the lining. There, you know, all these things have a lining over them, and if you get something between the nut and the lining, then it'll make a little pump knot, or punk knot if you're from here, or a pone if you're from Tennessee. That's what a corn pone is a dome-like shape of cornbread, okay? That's a pone. So you can get a pone on your back. It could be an abscess, big abscess, dome-like abscess. Any dome-like thing is a pone. Well, anyway, you can get a pone on your nut, and it could just be from that blood. But there's no way for you to tell, and there may not be any way for your provider to tell just by feeling it, so they may order an ultrasound just to look and see what it is. So, yeah, get that checked out. It's my same rule with blood in your stool. If you see blood in your stool for the first time, get it checked out. If they tell you, yeah, it's just a hemorrhoid and it's going to bleed and you see blood tomorrow, then you don't have to worry about it. So, all right. Thank you.
Hi, Dr. Steve. This is Phil in Tampa. I want to call you real quick. Excuse me, and give you a thank you, really, and give you a quick update. You and I had texted back and forth some time ago. I was taking Lexapro for anxiety, and that tanked badly, and then I switched to Prozac. And I just want to say it really meant a lot to me that you reached out to me and asked me how the Lexapro was going sometime after I told you. I mean, it really meant a lot that you took the time to do that. So I wanted to thank you for that.
Okay, well, thank you, and I'll play the rest of your call in a second. And I appreciate the feedback. When you all call in a voicemail, as long as you don't call from a blocked number, I'll try to text you back. Now, I get behind sometimes. There are people out there that, you know, 5 years ago sent in a voicemail and I never got back to them. I've got about 100 voicemails, and if you called in 4 or 5 years ago, someday you will probably get a text from me saying, hey, sorry, I'm getting back to you 5 years later. How's that rectal bleeding going? Because I really got behind pretty bad there for a while. I've more recently been staying up to date, but I'll try to text you back. He was impressed by the fact that I texted him back some weeks later saying, hey, how did the Lexapro go? Thinking that I was thinking about him the whole time he crossed my mind at all. What really happened, and I hate to blow this up because I'd much rather take the props for being a cool guy who cares about my listeners, but I do, but I just can't keep all this in my head. What most likely happened was he texted me back, and when I went back in 3 or 4 weeks later, I saw that I had a text message from somebody. You know, I'll always answer them. And I read the thread, and I just said, hey, how's it going with the new medication? So it looks like I'm very thoughtful. In fact, I'm just kind of going through my messages. But, you know, I guess that's more than some hosts do. And so I'll be happy to take the accolades for that. But, you know, this is my job, in my opinion, is to, if you guys reach out to me, to answer you back if I can. And if I ever haven't, I intended to, and just call me or email me or text me again, and I'll try to get back to you. Now, I don't give advice in the sense that, well, you should take this, this, or this, but I can give you information that you can take to your primary care provider and have them write whatever it is or see if they agree with my assessment. But anyway, all right, let's see if there's anything else on this.
I just have the Prozac as well. I had a bad reaction to it, too. While it wasn't as bad as Lexapro, Dr. Steve, I just don't think it's for me. During counseling, my counselor said that maybe I was trying to medicate for anxiety. That only happened, that was infrequent, and I was medicating for every day. So I've decided it's not for now. A lot of people have noticed improvement in me, my personality, appetite, things like that.
Okay, good. So he brings up a couple of really good points. One is, should you take something every day for something that only affects you every once in a while? And I think the answer is no for most things. For example, migraine headache. Get a migraine headache once every 6 months. It's severe, but it only happens once every 6 months. Should you take something every day in an attempt to prevent that? Well, how would you know if it's even working? Because if it's every 6 months, that means you could probably go 8, 9, maybe even 12 months without having one every once in a while just by chance. So it'd be hard for you to know that it was actually doing anything unless you went 3 or 4 years and went, wow, I haven't had a migraine. And they'd have to be pretty damn severe to justify taking something every day for that. It'd be much better in a situation like that where it's not lifestyle altering to any significant degree. If you have a migraine every 6 months, to find a regimen that will abort the migraine when it happens rather than trying to prevent something that's that infrequent. So he was having infrequent anxiety, but he was on Prozac, and the adverse effects were worse than what it was doing for him. So the risk in his situation was greater than the benefit. So he went off of it, and he found that his appetite's better. People are find him to be more engaging, and I'll bet his ability to have normal sexual congress with the partner of his choice has improved as well. So, these medications aren't for everyone. And if there was one perfect medication, we'd only need one medication. There's blue million antidepressants on the market because everybody's different. Everybody's internal neurochemistry is different. Everybody responds differently to these medications. The receptors are situated differently or in different number and concentrations, that kind of stuff. So it's really important to remember that. And if you get on a medication and you're just getting worse, talk to your provider about it. There may be a solution, and that may include just stopping that medication. So very good. Well, I'm glad you're doing better. All right.
I've been on a certain med for the last probably year and a half. It's supposed to help my A1C for my diabetes and supposed to reduce the risk of having a heart attack. And like I said, been on it for a year and a half. Last 6 months or so, I've had a itch on the right side of my testicle and everything, and soap it down every day in the shower and everything else. But I'm watching the commercial, which I generally ignore for this stuff, and it kind of caught my attention because one of the side effects was a yeast infection. Is it possible for a male to have a yeast infection? Just curious. Thank you.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you can get a fungal infection of the skin. You can get a yeast infection of the skin. Yeasts and fungi are basically the same thing. They're just different forms. You know, a yeast is the single cell version, and then the fungi are, you know, have hyphae. These are little branches. They, if you look at them under the microscope, they look like trees or vines. You can absolutely get it, and it's, I don't know that it's the medication that's causing it. It's the diabetes itself, because you've got more sugar in your or glucose in your sweat, in your body fluids, and therefore on your skin, and that's food for these things, and so they love it. And you know, if you have a medication and a statistically significant number of people, while they're studying this medicine, get hit by a bus, you kind of almost have to put, you know, 4% of people were hit by buses while on this medication as an adverse reaction. I mean, I'm exaggerating, but that's it's kind of true. So yeast infection may have been on there because people with diabetes are more likely to have fungal infections of the skin, just because of the amount of sugar that's being secreted in their fluids. So, so yes, you absolutely can. And you can treat it the same way too. So you can just go buy Monistat. If you really think that's what it is, you can do this test. You go buy Monistat over the counter and you just rub it on your balls for 2 weeks. And if the itching and all that stuff goes away, then you've kind of made the diagnosis. If it doesn't, go see your primary care provider. Let them do a scraping, and they'll look at it under the microscope, put some potassium hydroxide on it. Potassium hydroxide is a strong base. When you do that in solution, it will destroy human skin cells. So they just kind of disappear, but it will leave yeast and fungal forms intact so that they'll stand out. You can see them under the microscope at that point. So it's pretty cool. All right. All right. Well, hello. Oh, I am a, okay. Let me start this one over again. I'm an idiot. Here we go.
Hey, Dr. Steve. I got a little anecdotal thing for you. So I had a friend who was taking spray on magnesium. You know, you spray it on your skin a little bit before you go to bed, and it's supposed to help you sleep, I guess. So I tried it. And I used the exact dosage recommended on the bottle. You spray a little bit on the inside of your thighs. I guess this way it doesn't get all over your sheets and rub off. And then, you know, you go to bed. And let me tell you something. This stuff gave me the wickedest, most vivid dreams. And it felt like, you know, let's say I slept 7.5 hours. It felt like a full 7 hours of dreaming where I felt like I was tossing and turning, although I was asleep the whole night. So it just felt like I never was able to get out of this dreaming state. And when I woke up, I did it maybe 5 times, and I never felt rested because I felt like my mind was just churning all night. So I just want to know if you've heard of this at all. Or
yeah, magnesium is known particularly in alternative circles for enhancing sleep, and there is some evidence for it. There is, the hypothesis is that magnesium increases REM sleep. So you've got, if you look at a normal tracing of sleep, the mnemonic is LDR. So light, deep, and REM. And so the normal sleep cycle, although hardly anyone does this stereotypically textbook fashion, is you have light sleep, and then you go into deep sleep, and then you go into REM sleep, and then repeat, and then light, deep, REM. And then there's a lot of REM sleep right before you wake up as well. That's why you wake up in the morning. Sometimes you've been dreaming. That's why my kid can't wake up in the morning, because he's deep in REM, because his sleep cycle's all effed up, and no alarm clock will wake this kid up. So I'm looking at one sort of alternative article, and then we'll look at a PubMed article about this. Let me see where this thing says. Magnesium is a natural sedative that helps muscles relax, says Leslie Korn, PhD, a behavioral medicine clinician. Really? She's not a clinician. Oh, she's a MPH. What the hell is that? Is that a master's in pharmacy? Again, I'm not sure the term clinician is properly used here, but anyway, specializing in integrative therapies. Okay, so integrative therapies are like Dr. Scott, when he works in my clinic and does acupuncture on a patient with cancer pain, then that's sort of integrative medicine, where we're integrating an alternative, quote-unquote, modality with sort of traditional Western allopathic medical thing. So that's what she does. She specializes in things that have no data and integrating those into a practice where it's data-driven. It's sort of the cynical way of looking at it, but that's what it is. That's why people take magnesium supplements if they have trouble sleeping. Okay, that's great. That's not data. That just means that, you know, culturally people are taking these things. In fact, older adults with insomnia who took 500 milligrams of magnesium daily for 8 weeks slept better, dozed off faster, and were less likely to wake up too early compared to those that didn't the mineral, okay, didn't take the mineral. A study from Iran found. Okay, so where's the citation for this? Of course, there's no citation. You know, I think even if you're doing a goofy website, you should cite your sources. So let's go to the medical literature. Here's magnesium supplementation improves indicators of low magnesium status. Well, yeah, of course. And inflammatory stress in adults older than 51 with poor quality sleep. So what they were looking at is a baseline assessment of body mass index, diet, blood, and urine. And sleep quality, one group was given 320 milligrams of magnesium a day as a magnesium citrate. The other group, a sodium citrate placebo. Now, I like that. So they're even controlling for what the acid that it's hooked to. So citric acid, if you pop off one of the hydrogens and stick a magnesium on there, you get magnesium citrate. So or you can pop that hydrogen off and put a sodium there, and then you get sodium citrate. So they were even controlling for the acid, which I like this design so far. So magnesium citrate in one group, sodium citrate in the other for 7 weeks. The final assessments were made in 5 to 7 weeks, which were combined for statistical analysis. Okay. Let me see. Based on food diaries. Okay. Blah, 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 blah. Okay. Come on, you bastards. Magnesium versus placebo supplementation did not significantly affect serum magnesium. Well, that's interesting. When all participants were included, when only the 37 participants with serum magnesium concentrations that were low were analyzed, magnesium supplementation, but not the placebo, increased serum magnesium concentration. Well, no shit. So what they're really saying is that if you have a normal magnesium and you take magnesium, it doesn't affect anything. But if it's low, it'll bring it to normal. So that's good. I said no shit, but it's a subtle point. So what? Magnesium supplementation versus placebo decreased plasma C-reactive protein. And that's interesting. So in people who had elevated C-reactive protein. So I have an elevated C-reactive protein because of this autoimmune BS that I have. So maybe I should start taking that. So C-reactive protein is a measurement of total body inflammation. So when it's elevated, you've got inflammation somewhere. It doesn't say where it is or what it comes from, just that you have it. These findings show that many individuals have a low magnesium. So this doesn't say anything about sleep. Okay, because dietary magnesium intake did not change during the experimental period, another factor, possibly a placebo effect, improved sleep quality, which resulted in increased blah, blah, blah. This factor prevented... Shit, this study is not telling us exactly what we want to know. But anyway, let's do magnesium. But you can follow along with me. I'm taking a minute to do this because I think it's good that you see how you find out these things. I'm doing magnesium supplementation and sleep quality in PubMed.gov. So it used to be PubMed.com, then it was PubMed.org, and now it's PubMed.gov. This is the National Library of Science resource. It's got every peer-reviewed and some non-peer-reviewed articles in the medical literature for the last X number of years. There are some journals that don't make it. Some of those either the lower quality or lower readership, or they were open access. And apparently, I guess you have to pay a fee to get indexed if you're one of those. I'm not 100% sure about that. If somebody knows the answer to that, let me know. Okay. Here's the effect of magnesium oxide supplementation on nocturnal leg cramps. Now, that'd be a good one. We got 5 minutes. Hell, let's just take the last 5 minutes to look up magnesium supplementation. This one was randomized double-blind placebo-controlled clinical trial. Nicely done. And it showed oral magnesium oxide was not superior to placebo for older adults experiencing nocturnal leg cramps. So there you go. So magnesium probably isn't the best supplement for that. You know what is good? Tonic water. Tonic water is quinine. Quinine water, and quinine decreases nocturnal leg cramps pretty significantly. So you can do half a cup of tonic water with or without ice and lime, and that should decrease the number of episodes that you have of nocturnal leg cramps. Anecdotally, I can say it completely made mine go away. All right, let's see here. really, not a lot of studies on magnesium supplementation and sleep quality. So let me just do magnesium supplementation and sleep and see if something comes up. Okay, micronutrient inadequately in short sleep. No, I don't want to do that one. You know, this is the issue with this kind of stuff, isn't it? So this woman in this thing is popping off on how great magnesium is for sleep, and yet there really isn't a lot of data out here. Okay, here we go. The effect of magnesium supplementation on primary insomnia in the elderly, a double-blind, placebo-controlled clinical trial. Thank you for doing good science, at least structuring it properly. And this is that Iranian study that she was looking at. This is from the Faculty of Nutrition and Food Technology in Tehran, Iran. Supplementation of magnesium appears to improve subjective measures of insomnia, such as sleep score, sleep efficiency, sleep time, and sleep onset. Latency, early morning awakening, and likewise, so it's good for everything, and likewise insomnia in objective measures such as concentration of serum renin, melatonin, and serum cortisol in elderly people. So what did they consider elderly? I'm going to assume that means over 60, so I fall into that. And they gave them 500 milligrams of magnesium or placebo daily for 8 weeks. And then they did questionnaires of insomnia severity index, physical activity and sleep logs and stuff like that. They tried to control for caffeine. And so they found, and then they controlled for all this stuff. So they found no significant differences between the two groups at baseline, which is good. So they didn't have to control for anything. As compared to the placebo group, the experimental group brought about statistically significant increases in sleep time with a p-value of 0.002, which is pretty damn high. That's awesome. So we'll say 0.05 is statistically significant, which means one time in 20 this could be chance. So this would be 2 in, let me see, so that's 5, that's 2 in 1,000, so it's 1 in 500 that this could be by chance alone. So that's pretty darn significant. Sleep efficiency with a P of 0.03, which is statistically significant, and concentration of melanin and serum renin went up. These are sleep hormones, or hormones that are elevated in sleep. And it resulted in significant decrease in this ISI score. So that's good. Yeah. So I might try that, get back to you. I don't see a downside of supplementing with 500 milligrams of magnesium at night for a few weeks just to see if it helps. That's kind of cool. So I'm very interested in following that up. Let me see if there's anything else. I would like to see this particular article repeated. So that's the thing. With medical science, not only do you want to structure your trial correctly, but you also want to be able to show that your findings are reproducible. So I endorse this idea with one caveat. It hasn't, to my knowledge, been endorsed yet or reproduced yet, and therefore I can't endorse it wholeheartedly, but it is very interesting. Oh, I guess we're out of time. I can't forget wow. Rob Sprantz, Bob Kelly, Greg Hughes, Anthony Cumia, Jim Norton, Travis Teff, Lewis Johnson, Paul Ovcharski, Eric Nagel, Roland Campos, Sam Roberts, Pat Duffy, Dennis Falcone, Ron Bennington, and Fez Watley, whose early support of this show has never gone unappreciated. Appreciate Jim McClure's support over the last couple of years. And listen to our SiriusXM show on the Faction Talk channel, SiriusXM channel 103, Saturdays at 8 p.m. Eastern, Sunday at 5 p.m. Eastern, on demand, and other times at Jim McClure's pleasure. Many thanks to our listeners whose voicemail and topic ideas make this job very easy. Go to our website, drsteve.com, for schedules and podcasts and other crap. Until next time, check your stupid nuts for lumps. Quit smoking, get off your asses, and get some exercise. We'll see you in 1 week for the next edition of Weird Medicine.